There's a culture war going on in this country. We can no longer remain silent on the issues that affect us all. Decisions we make now will determine our future. But how do we engage with the culture in a way that honors Jesus? How do we rise above the noise to know what is right and what is true? It's time to bring God back into the conversation. It's time to reconnect. Here's Carmen.
Welcome, friends. I'm Carmen LaBurge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So how do we do that? How do we enter into the conversations of the day as the ambassadors of Jesus Christ? How do we speak the mind of Christ on the matters of the day in a way that honors Jesus? Let's face it, people don't need just another piece of our mind, but they very much do need the peace of the mind of Christ. So how do we give that to them? Well, I invite you to connect with us online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBurge. All right, friends. Today, President Trump announced the formation of a commission to combat the national epidemic of opioid addiction, as overdose becomes one of the leading causes of accidental death in America. He has tapped Chris Christie to lead the fight against the nation's opioid addiction crisis. And you may ask yourself, why Chris Christie? Well, New Jersey governor, Chris Christie, is leading this commission because, like most of us, the issue for him is quite personal. It was about a decade ago now that Christie's one of his best friends from law school developed an addiction to prescription drugs and actually died of an overdose in a New Jersey motel. You and I both know opioids are no respecter of persons. People get addicted to prescribed pain medication frequently. We have talked about this on prior occasions on the Reconnect, and we will certainly continue to do so as this commission does its work and as efforts in communities just like yours. As there are efforts that are successful, we want to be celebrating those, and we want to be letting other people know what those success stories are. I don't know about you. We certainly have people in our own life who are touched by this, dear friends of ours whose son died just a year ago of an accidental opioid overdose when he took prescribed painkillers following a car accident, but didn't know that he should not then also take other prescription medications that he had been prescribed for a chronic condition. So his young wife and their three-month-old baby woke up one morning and he did not. Opioids, indeed, they are not a respecter of persons, and it doesn't really matter what segment or sector of society we're talking about. Every single one of us knows someone who is dealing with either drug addiction or dealing with the reality of all the things that drug addiction steals from us. And we want to be praying for families that are touched by this, and we want to be praying for this new federal commission headed up by Governor Chris Christie to combat this national epidemic. My guess is that you've got a story, you've got a friend, you've got a colleague, you've got a family member who has battled with or tragically lost their life to a drug overdose. So I'll say that if the Trump administration can some creative way to address this particular scourge, I, for one, am listening. The president also just yesterday reversed former President Barack Obama's Clean Power Plan. So this is related to the Environmental Protection Agency. It is related to energy production and consumption in this country. Trump is making good on his promises to undo the Obama administration's war on coal. But there are lots of other factors at work here. So most of the response in yesterday's executive order is tempered. It's actually hopeful, but not as comprehensive as some might have expected based on Trump's promises during the campaign. So West Virginia actually reached its peak of coal production 20 years ago. But energy markets have moved on to natural gas and to other methods. And so actually returning coal production levels and even then after that, jobs related to coal to the kinds of levels they were at 20 years ago, it seems unlikely. And I think a lot of workers know this. And so I think that what we're talking about here are the personal stories, the personal losses, the personal loss of meaning. And so I think that we're going to have to recognize that returning dignity and jobs to the regions affected by the loss of the coal industry in many cases, in many places. You know, we're going to have to talk about creative ways of addressing economic recovery in those areas. These are our neighbors who want to work. They want to have the dignity of work, and they want to be doing things that are of value. And these are people who literally powered the country for years. But technology has, in many cases, moved beyond the need for folks to do these kinds of jobs. And so when we talk about the consequences of legislation, there are sometimes unintended consequences. And there are things that the government can regulate. You know, the government can be working to regulate something like clean air. But what does that mean for people who are doing the jobs on the other end of the legislation that's affected by that? So there's always human consequences. There's always a human toll to be paid. And sometimes that toll comes in the loss of jobs and entire towns losing their primary employer. And when that happens, you and I both know there's a cascading effect that moves down throughout the culture and throughout our families. And so certainly, again, let's be praying for folks in coal country, and let's be creative about what kinds of industries might be moved into those regions. What are the kinds of capacities that exist in those regions that don't rely on the extraction of coal from the ground by human hands? And so I just think that, you know, we're talking about really hardworking people. We're talking about a really beautiful part of the country, and surely we can find a way to do something creative. Maybe it could be the Silicon Valley of the East. All right. When we talk about unintended consequences, we probably need to lift up this story about the United States acknowledging that the Mosul airstrikes, the airstrikes in Mosul that killed hundreds of civilians, may have actually been us. That might have been us. The United States is investigating reports that as many as 200 civilians may have been killed in a coalition airstrike targeting ISIS militants in Mosul. So this story relates back to a bombing that took place, airstrikes that took place on March the 17th, in which the U.S. military participated. So the U.S. military acknowledged conducting a strike in this region, in this suburb of Mosul, where ISIS fighters were engaged in a battle with Iraqi forces. And it was the Iraqis who called in the airstrikes on these particular buildings because, according to the Iraqis on the ground, these were buildings from which these ISIS militants had stationed snipers. And so that's why these buildings were targeted. What was unknown at the time was that in the basements of these buildings, hundreds of women and children were sheltering. And so it took 5 days. This is probably for me, you know, just as a person thinking about not just what it would be like to be in a building that came crashing down, but for the fact that it took 5 days before any help, any rescue teams even arrived. And so there's certainly no survivors to be pulled from this rubble, and the number of dead is still unclear. The article that I'm reading from the New Yorker says it's not clear what the final death toll will be, but many of those killed were women and children. Security forces have been restricting press access to the site, and so really what we have is limited and sketchy. But it would be one of the worst losses of civilian life at the hands of the U.S. coalition forces since the beginning of the Iraq War in 2003, no matter what the final death toll ends up being. So here's the real question in terms of the Christian worldview. You know, supposedly this kind of targeting is supposed to make war, I don't know, safer? We're supposed to be better at targeting. And here's the question that we just have to keep asking ourselves. These are real people, and they're really trying to live in a real war zone. And there's still more than a half a million civilians in this part of the city of Mosul in which these coalition airstrikes are taking place at the request of the Iraqis and in opposition to ISIS militants. And certainly we want to eradicate ISIS. And so here's the challenge. Like, there's a righteous cause, but we're not talking just about moral wounds here, the moral wounds to, you know, these U.S. servicemen and women who now know that they're responsible for the death of potentially hundreds of civilians, not just enemy combatants, not just terrorists, but women and children. So we don't just have a moral wound of the individual. We really have a moral wound as a nation, or we should. And yet this system of warfare has really blurred the moral lines for us. Like, we are doing things as a nation that we're so distant from because, frankly, we don't have boots on the ground there, right? We're not talking about coffins draped with American flags coming home. We're talking about stuff that we're doing from a distance. And so I think that when we talk about the morality of war and we talk about just war and we talk about how it is that we, you know, go after the bad guy and get the bad guy, we're going to have really hard conversations as Christians from a Christian worldview. What does it mean for us to be targeting people who are virtually unknown and for whom we have no reliable identification until after the fact? What does it mean from a Christian worldview for the United States to be engaged in drone attacks that result in the execution of people in other countries without the consent of those sovereign states? What are we supposed to do with that? Certainly it's a more effective way of killing people, but at what moral cost? So what does it mean from a Christian worldview to escalate our involvement in a war that hasn't even been authorized by the Congress? See, you and I, we cannot sanitize war. As much as we want to keep our boys off of that battlefield, we can't sanitize war because war is hell. And I think it's important for us to remember that real people are living in that real hell in Mosul today. And a lot of them are women and children. And so as we think about what's happening in the world and we think about what's happening right here at home, and we think about how we here at home are engaged in things around the world about which we know very little, we need to be not only people of prayer, but people of humility. We don't, as Americans, necessarily know the answers to every question about everything that's happening everywhere in the world. That's God's job. That's God's job. All right, sticking with the international news for just a moment. From war to relative peace, Great Britain has taken the next step toward exiting the European Union. So reading here from the BBC, reposted by CNN, but it doesn't really matter. It's kind of alphabet soup at this point. The UK Prime Minister, Theresa May, will begin the formal process of ending Britain's 44-year membership in the European Union, kickstarting a 2-year process that will end in Brexit. So this actually happened today. She signed a formal letter to the European Union declaring that Britain is triggering Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty. Effectively, that's effectively the EU's rule book. So she's basically saying, we want out. All right. Now, I think you can think of this a little bit sort of as a declaration of independence of sorts, not from a monarchy. Britain is sticking with a monarchy, but independence from a failed effort to make Europe sort of one nation under anything but God. It's interesting to me that this event, this move toward Brexit, comes so closely on the heels of something that just happened this past Saturday. This past Saturday was the 60th anniversary of the signing of something called the Rome Treaty. Now, the Rome Treaty actually formed the European Economic Union. We think of the EU as something old. Well, it's actually only 44 years old, but it's 60 years old in terms of its foundational pieces. But you and I may think of the EU as even something older than that, something well established, something that's been around a really long time. But it's really a very new idea. And the idea was we would come to cooperative peace avoiding anything like World War II ever again, we would come to a cooperative peace among nations under the guiding light of secularism, and we would so interweave our economies with one another that we would never dare threaten one another with war again. So the Rome Treaty, signed in 1957, was intentionally devoid of God. If you actually read the Rome Treaty, you're going to say to yourself, I mean, they worked really hard to avoid any spiritual language whatsoever, to really avoid any recognition that Western civilization and the European culture was foundationally constructed upon the ethics of Christianity. It's avoided at all costs. And they avoided it at all costs because they didn't want to acknowledge the role of Christianity in the foundations of European flourishing. So it's no surprise that something that's completely and utterly based on secularism is now finding itself without a substantive foundation. Like, that's not surprising to me. But it's going to, I think, be surprising to those who still continue to hope that secularism is the way to go. Well, breaking up is hard to do, and so here's where it stands now. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, has signed this letter that formally begins the UK's departure from the European Union, giving official notice under Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, and that letter is being then delivered to the President of the European Council, and his name is Donald Tusk. So in a statement in the Commons, the Prime Minister will then tell the members of Parliament that this marks, quote, the moment of the country to come together. Now, so this is a process that actually takes a couple of years. It won't be complete until probably this time 3 years from now, 2 years from now, 2 years from now, 2019. So this will be an ongoing conversation, and in all likelihood, Britain won't be the only nation seeking to exit the European Union, although Britain has always had a little bit of a unique standing in the EU as they sort of had special rules they were living under anyway. All right, I got two more quick stories for you before we got to go to a break. Planned Parenthood, you might recall, is still quite upset about some videos that were these undercover videos that were produced by the Center for Medical Progress. You and I watched these videos with grief and horror a couple of years ago, and now the two people responsible for making those videos are now facing new charges in the state of California. So two activists who secretly filmed Planned Parenthood are charged with felonies is the headline in the USA Today. Two anti-abortion activists who filmed controversial undercover videos as they attempted to buy fetal tissue from Planned Parenthood have been charged in California with 15 felonies for allegedly invading the privacy of medical providers by filming without consent. So here's the deal. David DeLeiden and Sandra Merritt, who work for the Center for Medical Progress, are facing these charges in California after similar charges were dropped in Texas. And basically they're saying, the state of California is saying, we're not going to tolerate the criminal recording of conversations. Now, we tolerate abortion. We tolerate the ripping apart of children in the womb, but we're not going to tolerate abortion, or we're not going to tolerate the criminal recording of conversations. Here's the walk-off paragraph that I just will leave you with as we consider the need to be praying for David DeLeiden and Sandra Merritt as they face these charges. This is from Mary Alice Carter, the interim vice president of communications for Planned Parenthood. Here's what she said in a statement. As we have said from the beginning, more than a dozen different state investigations have made clear, quote, Planned Parenthood has done nothing wrong. Friends, if Planned Parenthood has done nothing wrong, there's going to be hell to pay before the judgment seat of God. I mean, that's just all I have to say about this. When we have so flipped the meaning of what is right and wrong, when we have said it's criminal to be recording conversations without the consent of those being recorded, that rises to the level of felonious activity that's going to send people to prison versus the not just the taking of the life of the unborn, but the turning around and selling it for profit, that's okay, that's not wrong, that's where we're at in our culture. If you wanted to know how dark the darkness has gotten, it's that dark. Okay, and finally, in terms of cultural awareness, sort of the what's going on out there, this week's episode of Oprah's megachurch drama Greenleaf, I think is going to have people talking. And my guess is it's going to have people talking not only about the show, it's going to have protesters out there. I'm just confident that there's going to be an uprising of concern about one of these particular storylines, and it's not going to be the first one I'm sharing. So you may not be familiar with Greenleaf. Greenleaf is Oprah Winfrey's mega church drama. And this week's episode, this Wednesday's episode, is called Strange Bedfellows, and it actually has two gay storylines in it. One of them regards self-discipline. That's the storyline that I'll talk about second. The first storyline is about church discipline. And so the rift forms over the decision to fire the church's gay choir director after he very flamboyantly, publicly flaunts his relationship with his new husband. And so the characters who are confronting this are the husband and wife duo, leadership team of this megachurch, Bishop James Greenleaf and his wife, Lady May Greenleaf. And they are concerned over money and church membership numbers. One of the church's biggest donors is demanding that this choir director be fired. Half of the deacon board is not fulfilling their pledges due to the issue. But the challenge inside the home of the pastors is pretty significant. They've got two daughters who are both trying to convince their parents to change their minds. Based on what? Based on feelings. Based on feelings. Gigi, one of their daughters, is an associate pastor at the church, and she's pouting, saying that firing Carlton is, quote, so dumb. It's immoral. The other says, well, it's just not very loving. And so the conversation about the generational conversation taking place is an important one, because this actually reflects the generational conversation taking place in most churches. There's a leadership generation in the church who knows the scriptures and understands the importance of God's design of human life and God's design in marriage and God's design for sexuality and sexual relationships in the context of one man and one woman exclusively. And that is not what the next generation, even of those raised in the church, necessarily feels. And it's based on feelings, and it's based on human relationships, not obedience to the Word of God in relationship to Him. So there is a dialogue that takes place between Lady May and Carlton that is surely going to have people in the culture talking. But it's the other storyline that's going to really get people going. And that is a positive storyline related to gay conversion therapy. There is a storyline in Greenleaf related to Charity's husband, who is dealing with same-sex attraction, and he is in a gay conversion therapy group, and he is making good progress there, according to this week's episode of the show. And so you may or may not know that there's a lot of controversy in the culture today about gay conversion therapy programs. And my guess is that when the LGBTQ plus people get a hold of this episode of Greenleaf, Oprah is going to find herself being picketed and protested and demand that she bow down. And that Greenleaf bow down, and that the church in Greenleaf bow down to the LGBTQ agenda. Because, you know, in our culture today, that's just something that you're just not allowed to believe is wrong. All right, so do you remember the Ebola crisis? I know it feels like a distant memory for us here in the U.S., but the outbreak actually happened in February of 2014. Hard to believe that it's been that long ago. 3 years ago, parts of Africa still dealing with the repercussions. Well, Samaritan's Purse, a ministry that many of us know very well, was already in Liberia when the epidemic broke. And they stepped up when many others fled. You may remember that the deadly virus infected one of Samaritan Purse's medical personnel. Kent Brantley was the doctor's name. And there was a nurse affected as well. Well, God did amazing things during this time. And there's a movie coming out about it. And it's called Facing Darkness. We've got an interview with Franklin Graham up on our blog today at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Go check it out, and when the film comes out, go see it. Hey, we got to go to a break, but we'll be right back. This is The Reconnect, reconnectwithcarmen.com. By the Lord our God. I'm Carmen LaBerge, and this is The Reconnect, where we're putting God in his place, back where he belongs, right in the middle of every conversation. So we're talking about the things that people are talking about, seeking to equip you to be an ambassador of the kingdom of God in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. We're also talking with the people who are helping to advance the kingdom of God in the world today. And so today I'm excited to be talking with Greg Gudorf. He is the CEO of PureFlix Digital, the worldwide leader in faith and family-oriented entertainment. He's a former executive with Sony. He's the inventor of he holds 22 patents. We're not going to talk about that today, but that might be an interesting conversation for the future. And you can find out about what we're talking about today at PureFlix.com. So in his role at PureFlix, Greg is leading the charge, in this subscription video on demand service. And we're going to talk about that because we all think of that as like Netflix, but there's actually Netflix for Christians. It's not called Netflix, but there you go. It's a way of understanding it. So we're excited to have Greg here today. Greg, welcome to The Reconnect.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Carmen. Thank you.
So now I'll just confess to you that I am one of those Christians in the culture who for a period of time just didn't go to the movies. And I didn't go to the movies because I don't like watching gratuitous sex. I don't like gratuitous violence. I don't like hearing language that, although common in the culture, is vulgar to my ears. So you don't have to convince me that there's a need for what PureFlix is doing, but go ahead and convince everybody else.
I appreciate that. Well, you know, we have a saying, no sex, language, or violence surprises with our content. We try to bring content to life on the screen, whether it's a television set, a telephone, or a consumer's tablet, so that folks can access good content anytime, anywhere. And good content, from our perspective, is faith and family-oriented content, something that'll feed the soul, have a positive message to it, and leave you feeling good as opposed to shying away from what you might get in typical Hollywood fare.
Okay, but immediately you and I both know you're going to get pushback. People are going to immediately say it's going to be now this is going to date me culturally, but it's going to be cheesy. It's not going to be as good qualitatively in terms of the value, the quality of the filmmaking, the quality of the production. Convince me otherwise.
Well, you know, there's always a wide variety of content out. There's plenty of cheesy Hollywood secular content, if you will, as well. The content that we find on our site, some of it may be in that cheesy category for some folks, but the majority we're finding has really stepped up the game as far as content of story, because storytelling is the whole key here, and the content of production quality. Take a PureFlix original series such as The Encounter. The first season we put up right at the end of last year, 8 episodes. Production quality on it is great. People have just raved about it. It's been one of the more popular viewings on the site. Production quality is there. There's no cheese factor involved. And yet it's got a message that's just powerful and speaks to a lot of the issues we see in today's world in a very Christian mindset perspective.
All right, and if a person wanted to see the Encounter original series, how would they go about doing that?
It's real simple. They can actually see it for free when they start a month trial for free at PureFlix.com. Just PureFlix.com, open an account, and you're off and running. You can view the Encounter. If you like it at the end of the month, you'll be billed for the next month, and you're off and running. You'll have access to almost 6,000 pieces of content on our platform right now.
Okay, so there are their original series on there. And then tell us what other kinds of things are available.
So original series are an important piece for us, just like it is for a Netflix or anyone else, you know, bringing that message and to your consumers that tells the story that needs to be told. But we have lots of feature films and everything from feature films to TV shows that are out and popular to sermons, preachings, and teachings. Right now on our site, you can find movies such as Do You Believe? The movie God's Not Dead 2 will be out shortly on our platform, so watch for that. You'll also be able to find TV shows like the Heartland series or the Ties That Bind series. These are TV shows that folks know from TV, and you can now watch on demand when you want and how you want from PureFlix.com. Additionally, you'll find teaching pieces such as Tony Evans, one of the featured preachers in the I Disciple series that we have online. Or you'll find lots of kids-oriented program, the VeggieTales series we have online. We also have lots of things associated with the educational needs. A lot of our customers are homeschoolers or folks just looking to supplement the education their children are receiving in school with Christian-themed teaching around history, geography, math, science, etc. So quite a variety of content amongst the 6,000 titles.
Okay, you probably sold me as a grandma on VeggieTales. So there you go. You should lead with that in the future. Folks, we're talking with Greg Gudorf, and he's with PureFlix. You can check out what we're talking about and everything else that PureFlix has got going on at PureFlix.com. Greg, one of the things that you mentioned is feature films, and I will I'll just go ahead and tell you I have been privileged to screen The Case for Christ. I can hardly wait for it to hit theaters, so I can take my family and we can take our friends. I'm actually going to interview Lee Strobel here on the show the day the movie hits theaters. So give us a glimpse from your perspective into The Case for Christ and what your hopes are for that movie in the culture.
Well, you know, it's such a great story, the story of Lee and Leslie Strobel and how they came to Christ, and how Lee thought, boy, this was kind of crazy when Leslie was the first one to step forward. But in his efforts to disprove it, he actually came to be a believer. It's such a great story. His books reached, you know, close to 15 million people from his books alone. And the excitement building behind this film, which opens April 7th in theaters nationally, is just really building nicely. I had a chance to talk with Lee and Leslie when I was in Orlando at the National Religious Broadcaster Show a couple of weeks ago. Great couple. You're going to enjoy your interview with them, and your listeners will love hearing about them. But we also screened the movie in Orlando for some of the attendees there. And I got to tell you, listening to the crowd respond to the movie, the little sniffles and the little sighs as different points were made, you can tell this movie touches hearts. In fact, after the show played out, it was about 10 p.m., we set up a camera for anyone who wanted to leave a short little testimonial. We thought maybe 30 minutes, we'd be done. People were there until half past midnight, leaving little video testimonials for us about this movie. It was unbelievable, the responses it drew from the screening crowd. I think people nationally, theater-going audiences nationally, are going to be really touched by it. And, you know, Carmen, there's one thing important, and this is from the Christian movie maker's perspective, but also the Christian audience perspective. I can't stress enough the importance of opening weekend. A lot of times someone will hear about a movie coming up and they'll go, oh, yeah, I'll get to it a couple of weeks from now, kind of a thing. But in the movie world, opening weekend determines how many more theater screens a movie will grow to or shrink from. So I'd encourage anyone who's looking to go see the movie, go see it that opening weekend, April 7th, at a theater near them, and help us spread the word and do the good that this movie, the Lee Strobel story, can really tell to audiences everywhere.
So, folks, you can actually, if you want to, you can actually pre-buy your tickets and invite somebody to go with you. One of the great things about The Case for Christ, if you're a person who's read the book, you already know this, but trust me, the film makes The Case for Christ for you in a way that you don't then have to turn around and make the case with your skeptical friends. It's a great movie to take a thinking person who is a skeptic about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. A person who questions whether or not this could possibly have historically ever happened. Maybe it's a person who has got a lot of medical training. Maybe it's a person who comes from the scientific community. Maybe it's just a person who is skeptical about Christianity because they've had a negative experience in the context of the church. Not everybody comes to their questions about Christ in the same way, but the answers that Jesus provides to the questions are universal. And so I encourage you, if you've got a friend, a family member, a neighbor, a colleague who is always needling you just a little bit because you're a Christian, one of the great things about when this movie comes out is that it's coming out on the weekend prior to Holy Week. So it's the Friday before Palm Sunday. So it's Friday, April the 7th that it comes out. You're going to have this opportunity then to turn around and invite that person to join you as you yourself as a Christian go through the events of Holy Week, experience anew the reality of the crucifixion and the atoning sacrifice of Jesus Christ, and then with everybody else, spend that day of darkness on the Saturday before Easter really wondering what is going to happen. And then you've got an opportunity to invite that person to go with you to church. One of my colleagues here in the office in our time of prayer this morning, you know, that's the burden on her heart. Who is it in my circle of friends that God really wants me to invite into our Easter experience? Who am I supposed to be including in my Easter experience? Well, if inviting a person to church is scary, inviting them to a movie is not. And so let me encourage you to use this. This is a gift that PureFlix is giving us. They're giving us this gift of the opportunity of making the case for Christ with our neighbors and our friends through a film that is superbly made, and its content is just fantastic. So that'll be my appeal to my listeners to use what culture is providing to you. This is literally being handed to us as an opportunity to reach the world for Jesus Christ. So, Greg, thank you for providing us with this tool, with this, we don't have all the tools that we need, but guys like you put them in our hands. And so thank you for expanding our capacity as believers to share with our neighbors and with our friends the good news of the gospel.
It's going to be a great tool, Carmen. You said it very well. You know, the way that this movie gets its message across with the story of a journalist, a child, a family, a marriage, and Christ comes together in a very powerful way. We're glad to be a part of it and bring it to people everywhere.
Yeah, and you make a really good point there. I would like to say to people, this is not really what I would describe as an evangelistic film. This is really a film about marriage. Like, tell your friends that you want to take them to a film about marriage, because the witness of Leslie in this film and what happens in their marriage and who she is as a believing woman, unequally yoked to a non-believing man. I got a lot of friends, Greg, who are in that circumstance. I think that this is a film that's going to speak to women across the country in really, really profound ways. And I hope it then in turn, speaks to men whose wives have been praying for them, whose wives have been witnessing in very quiet ways to them, whose wives have been on their knees before the Lord asking that God would give their husbands a heart of flesh to replace the heart of stone. Greg Gudorf of PureFlix, you guys can check out everything that PureFlix has got going on, including the streaming video service at pureflix.com. Greg, thanks so much for being with us today on the Reconnect.
Bless you, Carmen. Thank you very much.
All right, friends, it's time to go below the fold. This is the time in the show when we like to lift up stories and make connections that are designed to help you start and engage with others in conversations that may not initially appear to be about God, but where the introduction of eternal principles can change not only the conversation, but the course of another person's thinking and maybe even their living. That's the way this works, right? We introduce ideas. Ideas have consequences. If I can plant the seed of an idea in your head, which frankly is what I'm doing every day, right? Every day that you give me the opportunity to speak into your life, I'm trying to plant an idea. I'm trying to plant a seed. And I'm trusting that by the power of the Holy Spirit, that seed is going to get watered and fertilized, and it's going to grow, and it's going to take root in your head and your heart and in your life, and it's going to then bear fruit. And then you're going to let me know what fruit that bore, right? You're going to let me know the impact of the ideas that we're planting here on the Reconnect. So any feedback you ever want to give me, you can always text me at 877-655-6755. Again, that's 877-655-6755. There's no limit to the amount of text you can text me on that text line, so just text away. But you can also give me feedback online. The website is reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can post on our Facebook page, Reconnect with Carmen. And you can always let me know what you're thinking about on Twitter, but that's only 140 characters. But I'm at Carmen LaBerge. All right, and I would love to know your feedback. I would love to know, hey, you planted this idea in my head. You got me thinking differently about this thing. You said this, and I did this, and here's what happened. Or, hey, here's a question here's a conversation that's happening in my community or in my little circle of friends, and I don't know how to get God into that conversation. Can you help me? I love that. I would love to respond to that. I would love to make that subject matter of the show, but I got to hear from you. So, again, the text line is 877-655-6755, and it's always open. You don't have to do it during the show. It's just always open. Okay, so today's Below the Fold is about the American dream. Is the American dream still a thing? I mean, I think that's a huge question. Like, is the American dream still a thing? And if so, how do you define it? Like, how is that defined today? How would the American dream be defined? If we went out and we, like, surveyed 100 people on the street, you know, what is the American dream? And is it still a thing? I wonder what they would say. Well, Forbes, of Forbes magazine, but also of Forbes.com, they think it's still a thing. So they actually have launched the American Dream Index because, you know, they got to have something else to count. They're bean counters, and they got to have beans to count. So here's the beans they're going to count this year. So they have launched the American Dream Index using 7 indicators of economic health, tracking state by state on a monthly basis whether or not President Trump is actually making America great again. So there you go. This is what's going on because Forbes believes that that's essentially the promise that people think President Trump has made to them. People think that that President Trump, during his campaign, promised essentially breathing new life into the American dream, which Forbes says means breathing new life into the middle class. It means returning middle class people to at least a sense of prosperity. So that's what the conversation is about here. Is the economy strong enough to deliver on the American dream, which is prosperity for the middle class? So that's the question that Forbes is seeking to address by this American Dream Index. They're trying to capture the way the middle class feels and is responding. And here's the thing. You can't actually capture feelings. The number crunchers can't capture feelings. So the number crunchers capture numbers. And so they're basically saying, look, you can't judge middle-class prosperity based on doctors who are making $150 an hour, and you can't do it based on retail hourly clerks that are making $9 an hour. Like, you can't do that because neither one of those people is in the middle class. And so what they're saying is that the middle-class prosperity, this could be called the middle-class prosperity index, but that's not nearly as catchy as the American Dream Index. So it's called the American Dream Index, but it varies considerably state to state, which is why they're doing this on a state to state basis. Now, why does it vary state to state? Well, because layoffs tend to occur in one place at a time, as do the launching of the rise of new industries. So Here, I'll just give you the starting list. Right now, in terms of the American Dream Index, the top five states where the middle class is experiencing the greatest prosperity, number one is Nevada, number two is Tennessee, number three is Florida, number four is Arkansas, and number five is Georgia. What was surprising to me is that four of the five are in, I mean, aren't they in the SEC? Aren't all four of those? I think those are like SEC states. Like, that's the Southeast. So interesting then to look at the ones that are worst off. Worst off, counting down 46 to 50, Kansas, Illinois, Connecticut, Hawaii, and dead last is Alaska. And the reason that Alaska right now is because the loss of oil jobs. But also, though, there's some advantages to living in Alaska that I don't know everybody knows about. Like, you get, like, moose. Like, you get a moose tag. If you live there, you get a moose tag. You get to hunt a moose. So I don't know. That seems to me like a middle class prosperity index thing that Forbes is probably not not considering when they put Alaska last on the list. I'm just saying. Okay, because Alaska's also beautiful, and living in a beautiful place maybe should account for something. But there you go. Okay, it's an interesting conversation starter nonetheless, which is really what this is all about. This is about how do I start or engage in an interesting conversation. So the American Dream Index that Forbes is providing to us, and they're going to be providing it every month, which is why I'm giving you this now. So you can be like, hey, there's a conversation starter I could like put in my back pocket, and I could whip it out at any point in time that I need to start a conversation with somebody. So here it is, because this one is just going to work forever, because every month we're going to get an update on this. So I think that the question about the American Dream Index is just a really good segue into a conversation about what we dream, what we hope for, what we envision as the positive possible future, not only for us, but for our kids, for our children and our children's children. It isn't just about, you know, hey, I'm like, I don't know, I'm getting kind of old. What am I, like 20 years from retirement? Maybe 15, 20 years from retirement, right? I mean, I got some years left in me, but really the group of people that's now coming into the labor force, like they're the ones who I want to be. I want them to be dreaming really big dreams, huge dreams, giant dreams. I want them to be dreaming the kind of dreams that Elon Musk is dreaming. You know, I want them to be dreaming the kind of dreams that They don't just imagine a cure for cancer. They like demand it. They like go after it. They're gonna find it. Like the dreams that say, hey, it, you know what? There's plenty of water in the world. In fact, there's the same amount of water in the world today as there was on the day of the flood. The big flood, the Noah flood. Okay? If there was enough water to cover the whole earth, there's a lot of water somewhere. It's not like it went away. It's not like it's still somehow in the system. It's here. So the fact that people don't have water is a little bit ludicrous. It's more than a little bit ludicrous. Like, let's get on that problem. So when I talk about dreams, I don't want to just say, hey, my dream is to have a house in the suburbs with a white picket fence and a three-legged dog. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's your dream. But that's kind of small. Like, you're a Jesus person. Can't you have a bigger dream than that? Couldn't you dream for, like, not just no child to be left behind, but no child to grow out without a forever family? Like, could that be our dream? Could we dream together that the foster care and adoption issue in our country would be solved in this generation? Could we dream together that that kids in the inner city would actually have access to healthy food, because those of us who live out in the country and produce more in our gardens than we could ever eat find a way to actually make it available to them? Like, that does not seem hard. And yet, we still have a hunger problem in our country. So you probably know families that live in, you know, this like food desert of urban America. Well, you don't live in a food desert, my guess is, right? You live in an abundance garden. And so how can the abundance garden people and the food desert people, how can we get to know each other? How can our dream be to get to know someone else so well that together we can solve the problems that people are facing that are keeping people from dreaming impossible dreams? Hey, dreams that are within our reach or within our set of resources, those aren't really dreams. Those are just good goals. I want you to dream things that you couldn't reach unless God was involved. So I want some God-sized dreamers out there. If you're a Christian, you ought to be dreaming big, really big, God-sized dreams, not just American dreams, but kingdom dreams. Let me know what they are at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Hey, friends, we're totally out of time today. I love being with you. Thanks for listening. Join me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. Have a great day, and God bless.
The Reconnect is brought to you by the Presbyterian Lay Committee. To continue the conversation and become part of the Reconnect community, visit reconnectwithcarmen.com.